fast asleep. Good morning to all of you. This is Gesundheit with Jacobus. We are at the halfway point. And that means, actually it means nothing. It just means that the first hour and a half went by very quickly. And we have Dr. John Neustadt on the program, a naturopathic physician who graduated from Bastyr University. He moved to San Diego with his family, and he is practicing over there in his own way, working primarily on new formulas and research. We have a caller waiting patiently. Good morning, caller. Thanks for joining the program today. What is your name? How can we help you?
Hi, Jacobus. This is Mary.
Mary, good morning to you.
I just want to let you know that women who have children,
yeah,
sometimes they can develop pelvic prolapse from, you know, pushing down during childbirth.
Okay.
And that can push down on the bladder, and you can have constant, constant urination. I had pelvic prolapse surgery done several years ago, so I want to know if he's had experiences with that, because I have to get up every 4 to 5 hours at night.
Oh.
Urinate. I can't sleep through the night, okay?
Okay. Well, thanks, Mary. I appreciate
Bye-bye.
That. You bet. Bye-bye. Dr. Neustadt, did you hear the question?
Yeah. After childbirth, it's not uncommon to have more frequent urination during the night, called nocturia, getting up at the night, in the middle of the night, or, you know, even when they sneeze or women sneeze or laugh, to have a little bit of urine come out. And it's an anatomical issue that's happened. There's been, you know, with the baby coming through the birth canal, there's changes in the anatomy that can cause that. And as Mary mentioned, there one specific change is called a pelvic prolapse, and surgeons can go in and help with that. Unfortunately, Mary, I wish I had a solution in terms of you getting up every 4 hours, other than what I'm about to say, which I hope will help you, and that is that where I've had some success is to stop drinking any liquids earlier in the night. And that may just take some experimentation with how long, whether it's 2 hours before you go to bed or 4 hours before you go to bed, to find out what might work for you. But if you are not producing as much urine because you're not drinking as much, now I encourage you during the day to stay well hydrated and make sure you're drinking lots of water. But at night, if you haven't tried it, you may want to try reducing the amount of liquids you're taking in before bed, and that may help.
Yeah, that's a good point. Dr. John Neustadt, my guest, and we are discussing sleep. What a phenomenal explanation you gave us about sleep architecture. That was so good. I really learned a lot from that. One of the other thing is we need to look at potentially hormones or gender as explanations why people have such a hard time sleeping. Are you agreeing with me on that?
Absolutely. It's very important. It all comes down to the question of potentially what are the underlying causes of what's going on. And women are more likely, 40% more likely than men, to suffer at some point from insomnia. And there could be hormonal regulation issues. It could, if it cycles with their menstrual cycles and their periods and the hormone fluctuations with that. We know that menopause and the drop in estrogen at menopause can cause insomnia. Hot flashes actually during the night can wake women up during perimenopause and after.
Yes.
There's actually some good research on pine bark extract, a clinical trial, using the amount actually that's in my sleep relief product. That's why I put it in there.
Yeah.
It's a great antioxidant, tons of wonderful health benefits from pine bark extract. But the study actually showed in women who were getting hot flashes at night that it helped them sleep better. Their sleep improved when they were, significantly improved when they were taking it. But low estrogen, just like in other low hormones, can cause insomnia. Low testosterone can cause insomnia.
Huh.
Low progesterone can cause insomnia.
Yeah.
Pregnenolone can cause insomnia.
Low
pregnenolone, exactly.
So that is an interesting thing, because low pregnenolone may happens quite a bit to people who are on statin drugs to lower their cholesterol for the right or the wrong reasons. But since cholesterol produces hormones and the first one it makes is pregnenolone, it may therefore happen to people who are taking these drugs. Is that true or not true?
Well, I think if you get cholesterol too low, it is the precursor hormone that it may affect any of the downstream hormones. If you just have less of it around and that's the raw material, then yes. I don't know of any research specifically correlating the two, but I haven't looked at that. So you may be absolutely correct. I haven't searched for that research to see the statin drugs. One of the side effects, and there are many, is one of the side effects, decreased steroid hormones like pregnenolone.
Mm. Now, since you are talking about hormones and you mentioned I'm thinking all of a sudden about thyroid disorders, which I think you as a naturopath have discovered that the parameters that on medical lab testing is done, where the TSH is called normal between 0.30 and almost about 5.0, that parameter is way too broad, and that many people are actually in a low thyroid state, a hypothyroid state, which could have as a side effect insomnia. And then they're not diagnosed correctly, because for the most doctors, they're in the normal range. It's not considered a problem. But if they could just get the thyroid functioning better, their insomnia could actually be improved.
Great point with the testosterone and not testosterone, thyroid hormone and laboratory values. And we see that with different lab values as well, that the range that's used oftentimes by labs is not the optimal. So how a laboratory creates a reference range is they take 100 people, let's say, or 1,000 people.
Yes.
And they take the value from those lab results, the values, all of them.
Uh-huh.
And they do some math on it, and they say, okay, 95% of all those results we're going to call normal.
Correct.
Doesn't mean it's healthy. It just means it's quote-unquote normal.
Yes.
And by definition, 2.5% of those lab values that are in the upper end are going to be considered high.
Yes.
And 2.5% at the lower end are going to be considered low.
Yeah.
Years ago, the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists came out with a recommendation that the reference range of what's considered high for TSH, so for thyroid, if a TSH value is high, it means the thyroid gland is underactive, that there's not enough thyroid hormone, that be lowered to about 2.5.
Really?
And some labs, a lot of labs are still using that. Some labs are using higher values, like you said, 3 all the way you know, to 5.
Yes.
But if somebody's above, 2.5 or higher, you always want to correlate any lab value to symptoms if we can, because it's important to treat the person and not the number on a test, which is another bit of a pet peeve of mine. I've talked a lot about bone density scans and osteoporosis and the testing. You always want to correlate it to the clinical endpoint, the thing that's most clinically relevant for the patient.
Yes.
And so with thyroid, you want to screen and make sure, are they having symptoms? And usually what I see usually with low thyroid is excessive sleep. They're tired all the time, not insomnia.
Okay.
But what would be called hypersomnia. They're tired a lot.
Okay.
Then when that value gets corrected, their sleep can improve. What we see with insomnia is a Graves' disease type picture, or hyperthyroid, too much thyroid hormone can cause racing heart, can cause insomnia, excessive sweating, anxiety, and that can be induced also by medication. If somebody's over-medicated with thyroid, which I've seen, unfortunately, too often, they're given too much thyroid hormone, then it can put them into a hyperthyroid situation where they can get insomnia. It also increases their risk for osteoporosis and other problems as well.
Okay, very interesting. So fatigue is more with hypothyroid.
Correct.
Insomnia you see more with Graves' disease or hyperthyroid.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Huh.
And any, you know, hormone disruptions, you know, it's a delicate balance between the hormones. You want to have them in a nice, healthy, you know, physiological range. People who are on testosterone supplementation, so low testosterone can cause insomnia, and, you know, elevated testosterone can cause people to have insomnia as well, because they've got too much energy and anxiety and they're not sleeping. So it can be both ways. It's not always that if it's low, it means you're getting, you know, too much sleep or you're getting insomnia. You can get, whether it's high or low with some hormones, can have the similar results.
Yes.
With thyroid, it's different. But with testosterone, whether it's low or high, it can cause sleep problems. Estrogen, typically, we're looking, if it's just low, then that causes sleep issues.
Yes.
And one thing to screen for and people to ask themselves that's too often overlooked by clinicians is a history of traumatic brain injury.
Oh, wow.
So all of those hormones that we mentioned, there's a cascade where the thyroid hormone, for example, is ultimately produced in the thyroid gland in the neck. Estrogen is produced in the ovaries. Fat cells can produce estrogen. Testosterone is produced in the testicles. But the precursor hormone, what starts all of that, initiates that cascade of and those steps of reactions to create the hormone and to cause it to be secreted in the body, starts in the brain,
okay.
In the central nervous system, okay. In the brain. You mentioned the pineal gland. Well, there's another gland called the pituitary.
Yes.
Gland in the brain.
Yeah, big one.
And the anterior pituitary creates all these hormones that stimulate the production and secretion and release of all these other hormones. And that tissue of the brain is very delicate. It's literally fat. The brain is primarily composed of fat. With anybody who has cut through a piece of fat can know that it can be quite squishy and soft.
Yeah,
especially if it's warmed up, and our body temperature is, you know, typically, you know, 98.6 degrees, and there's no protection around our brain.
Yes,
and inside our skull, on the inside of the skull, there are actually some bone. The inside of the bones, there's some points on them. They can be kind of pointy in there, and what happens in an accident, whether it's falling off a horse, or a motor vehicle accident, or falling and hitting your head when you're skiing, even if you have a helmet on, playing football. I know the Super Bowl is tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, those concussions that occur, that the repetitive nature of that. But even if it just happens once, you know, boxing, another sport where that happens a lot. Soccer, which I know that you played for years.
Yes.
You know, that it can happen a lot there as well. But what happens is your brain gets jostled around in its case. And it can impact that bone and cause damage to the delicate tissue in the brain that produces those hormones. And what happens is later on in life, it could take 10 years after the event for us to actually see the results. It can be sort of a low simmering issue that doesn't show itself for many years later. But a study out of, you know, 450 patients, one study, 50% reported insomnia symptoms in one study of traumatic brain injury. And when we run hormone panels on these people who have a history of it, it shows them low in specific hormones. It could be thyroid, it could be estrogen, it could be testosterone, it could be other hormones that we haven't even talked about, or and some pattern of that. And when we give them the hormone as a medicine to replenish it, to just get it back into the normal range, they tend to get better, and their sleep tends to get better.
Yes.
We're restoring the normal physiology.
Wow, that is really powerful stuff, what you tell us there, Dr. Neustadt. I tell you that, I mean, if I understand it correctly, I do know the anterior pituitary is also responsible for the production of cortisol and adrenaline in the adrenals. And so if that is disrupted, then it can really give people this adrenal imbalance in what they do in the production of DHEA and adrenaline and cortisol. Am I on the money on this one?
You are, except it's the posterior pituitary gland that has that, but still it's the pituitary.
Oh, the posterior does that?
The posterior, yeah, it works with those what's called neuroendocrine hormones, corticotropin-releasing hormone, for example.
I thought that they were dealing more with the kidney function, but the posterior, so, yeah.
And so, yes. And those are the hormones, cortisol, for example, that on a panel looking at traumatic brain injury, aldosterone maybe is another one that it could be important to test and look at.
Yeah, because then the way you explain it, I would say your brain has been scrambled, so to say, because of years of hitting or explosions or being in the war, and it starts making people, it affect the adrenals in a way that they become hypervigilant and that they can have these anxiety disorders that are and the cravings for sugars and that all could be related to adrenal issues.
Correct, adrenal issues and or decreases in other hormones as well because of that. It doesn't even have to be a physical hitting of the head, and it doesn't have to be multiple times. It could be even after one, depending on the person and the severity. But we see it in veterans, unfortunately, with closed head wounds, the blast trauma.
Yes.
People who are the ones who go in first and are setting blasts and charges to blow up doors and enter buildings or are out in the field in combat and exposed to the impact on their body and their brains of the shock waves from a blast without necessarily even having any open wounds that they experience.
Right. Wow. Dr. John Neustadt's website is NBI, Nutritional Biochemistry Inc., nbihealth.com. His phone number, if you need to get a hold of him afterwards and want to set up an appointment, it's 800-624-1416, 624-1416. Boy, what an amazing linking that you do here for us in about the brain and sleeping and the hormones and how all this can be connected. And how is it, young children have a tendency to be very awkward. And, of course, they're lower to the ground, so you wouldn't expect that they would have brain scrambling going on. But they have a tendency to fall over and to hit their heads and to get all these issues that happens at that young an age. Is there any research done that you are aware of? Is that a possibility for future issues such as ADD, ADHD, anxiety, insomnia, etc.?
That's a fascinating question. I don't know of any research that supports that or contradicts it, frankly.
Okay.
But there is an interesting thing with children's anatomy that could protect them that we don't have as adults.
Okay.
So one is, there are two things. One, the sutures, that is the in the brain, the skull is comprised of different bones.
Yeah.
And different lobes in the brain. So there's the occipital bone on the back. Each side there's the parietal bone. There's the frontal on the front. And these all come together, and they're sort of stitched together, if you will, or they're connected by what are called sutures. And when we're young, those aren't fully formed. You know, when you come out of the birth canal, you know, the baby's head is larger than the birth canal, and that gets squeezed, and that's why babies can come out with, you know, looking like they've got little cone heads.
Yes.
And, you know, over time, that just, you know, can cause some concern in new parents of, oh my goodness, what happened? But over time, it's natural, and then things settle down, the skull will assume its, you know, healthy anatomical shape. So the fact that those sutures are not fully, you know, solidified yet, when a baby falls, it allows the some potential movement in the skull to absorb some of that impact, not necessarily be transmitted all the way into the brain. And the second is the bones tend to be, you know, are softer in babies. And they're not fully calcified, and there's more collagen and connective tissue when we're younger. So that's why a baby and an arm, a long bone, for example, in an arm, can get what's called a green stick fracture. It's a specific type of fracture we see in children where because the bone is softer.
Okay.
And so that also may allow for during a fall of a child to absorb the impact, disperse it over a wider area, allow the bone to absorb more of it and not necessarily impact the brain as much. Now, I'm going off of just principles of anatomy and knowledge of anatomy and also my knowledge of osteoporosis, and that's what we see with healthy bone and osteoporosis and why people fall and they don't fracture.
Yeah.
But I think it's applicable here, and I don't know of any research showing that when children fall, they would get ADHD and those things, because every child I know has fallen a lot.
You bet. I got to run. We got to close up here for this hour because we're at the break. So, folks, stay tuned. We will be right back with Dr. Neustadt.
Activating the unused portion of your brain.
Winning.
Gesundheit with Jacobus every Saturday morning.